It's This Week in Rees. All this and more coming up on This Week in Rees.
High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
Duchess Nukem 3D.
Nickel plating.
And iTouch, a Mac.
All this and more coming up on this week's show.
Up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.
Hello, everyone. How are you all? Chris, tell us about your migraine.
Oh, yeah, I had a migraine last night and sort of been recovering today, popping as many pills as I can and feeling sorry for myself on the couch. But it did give me some chance to catch up on some YouTubing, including, and I love it when things like this happen, just the other night I was thinking, I wonder if Alex at the Arcade Archive has got a battle zone, because I wouldn't mind some footage of one for something I'd like to put together. And what does he drop? What's the next video he drops after I've had that thought? It's a video on a full upright battle zone with the periscope and everything, exactly what I wanted to see. So that's fantastic to see that there. And one of the other ones I caught up with only today, actually, Reese, so it's good job that you're here, is the second part, I think it was, of your America trip, where you visit the Atari pinball, or you look at some Atari pinball machines, which was really cool to watch. Really enjoyed that. And also, I think at the Zoltan machine, your wife making a wish that you'd go big.
Yes.
And that's kind of happened, hasn't it? Because of, well, tell us about this new space that you're moving into.
Yeah, well, it's funny you should mention the battle zone as well, actually, because I went to the cave the other weekend. It's a shame Neil isn't here this week, but we went out for dinner afterwards, as you do, and Neil kind of took advantage of me in my inebriated state. I mean, do you want me to go into details?
Yeah, sure.
Or I think I should.
Leave it just at that. No.
Tell us what you mean. It's funny. You mentioned Alex's new battle zone, because he actually had the cabaret machine before and now he's looking to sell it. And Neil had basically heard that I'd got this new space and he said, oh, do you want a battle zone cabaret, whatever they're called, arcade machine for your new space? And obviously I'd had a few to drink and I was like, oh, maybe. And next thing I know, I'm getting messages from Alex saying, oh, I hear you're interested in my battle zone machine. So yeah, we'll have to see what comes of that. It's all kind of covered in the video, but I got talking to my old boss a few weeks back, and he's had this office that's sort of 2 minutes down the road from my house that's been empty for quite a while, and basically has agreed to let me use it as a kind of second filming space / space to sort out all of my stuff. So yeah, I've been fitting that out over the past few weeks with some shelving and some desks and stuff, getting all of my computer collection in there. So yeah, watch this space. You should be seeing that on the channel in the very near future.
I'm quite excited by it. I think at the start it was intended just to be a bit of space for you to allow you to work on things, and now it's grown arms and legs and I'm getting more excited about it. I watched a supporters video came out last night. I won't spoil what the name of it is, but what are you not going to call it that you've been winding people up with?
Yeah, so the name I came up with was the Rees Museum of Computing. I think it's okay to use those.
RMC.
Those initials,
I like
is it.
I like yeah, it. What would you have thinking, as a logo?
Well, I was thinking, I mean, red's my favourite colour, so maybe like a big red R. Maybe I could sort of tilt it at an angle, maybe.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Make it a bit pixelated. That'd be awesome. Yeah,
retro
like
looking.
It. I'm excited. I'd watch that.
RMC. No, there is a good name for it, and I think you'll end up going with this one. It sounded like that when I watched a video about it, but we'll see. I have been ill this week. I have the dreaded lurgy. I've had it since last Monday. Last Monday I was feeling a bit ropey, and then the past week I've been feeling ill, and this morning I'm not feeling so good at all, but it is cheering me up speaking to you two, so that'll hopefully get me through this and then I can go back to my bed. Shall we go on with it? Oh, I should say Neil is not here this week. Neil will be back next week, and we should have four of us on next week. We've got a guest coming on as well, so next week should be fun with Neil's return. But shall we go on with the show?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's make sure we get it all done in one take, hey?
Yeah. Like professionals.
It's the second take. I don't like the term boomer shooter, but I really do like the genre. Just hate that title, makes me feel old. And none were finer than Duke Nukem 3D, of course. Back in the day, I remember waiting and believing that the much-hyped sequel would come out. And of course, it did in the form of Duke Nukem Forever many, many years later. But we all know that that wasn't the sequel we were expecting. No, this isn't a rehash of the story that we did already cover about the leaked dev files of the original sequel to Duke 3D. This is something else. Something better. This is what is being called the spiritual successor to Duke 3D. So the description on Steam, I'll read it out for you. You're an exterminator. You kill things for a living. When a hostile invasion of alien cockroaches rocks your city, you've got a job to do. A high-octane retro FPS inspired by some of the best games of the 90s. Yep, with a gender-flip protagonist, The Last Exterminator is a brand new boomer shooter that appears to look, sound, feel, and has the same humor, most importantly, as Duke himself. And with a real retro aesthetic to it, it actually looks closer to what we're expecting from the vaporware of Duke Nukem Forever than we actually got. You play Kira Parker, a down-on-her-luck bug exterminator who's pissed as hell that the alien bugs have shot up her van that she was living in. There's stories about this on Kotaku and PCGamesN.com, and I'm sure other outlets as well, and there's a trailer on YouTube as well, and I'll point to all of those as the sources of truth in the show notes. As well as some gameplay footage that I've recorded myself that Duncan can slot in. The release date is to be announced, but there is a free playable demo on Steam. So I downloaded it and played it. I thought that was the best way to cover this story, and I certainly wasn't going to miss out on the opportunity to play something being hyped as the spiritual successor to Duke 3D. And I absolutely loved it. It just feels like Duke. It's got interactive objects, which were so sort of unique to Duke at the time. Some things as simple as light switches and working lifts and public telephones that mostly seem to lead to pranking someone that sounds suspiciously like Duke. and just the pacing and the weight of the game is just so well done. And it's got lots of movie-inspired quips in there as well. I'm really excited about this. Are you excited, Dave?
Well, are you going to reach through the screen and punch me if I take us a bit off on a tangent away from it? I'm going to do it anyway. But first of all, I've not played all the way through the original Duke 3D, so it isn't that I'm sitting here thinking I'm itching for more Duke 3D. I've run out of Duke 3D. However, I've heard such good things about this, and not just before you picked as a story. I've heard such good things about it before you picked as a story, that maybe I should go ahead and just play this and when I next want to play Duke 3D, play this instead. What I was going to talk about, though, is a game called Moonring, which is, according to the Steam description, a dark fantasy turn-based retro fusion of classic turn-based RPGs and roguelikes, all presented with a unique neon aesthetic. And it's a free game on Steam. And when I read the description, it sounded just so much like the premise of this. It's a high-quality remake without using the proper IP that people are saying really good things about. So it's to Ultima what this is to Duke 3D. So I'm quite excited about that one. I'll play that, I think, soon. One question on this, though, and I think it's essential if I'm going to think of this is what it's like to play Duke 3D. Does it capture the same kind of B-movie-style sense of fun that Duke 3D had, and not the overly lads of Duke Nukem Forever? I don't know if you felt that way the same way I do, but I preferred the tone of Duke 3D. I thought it was, I preferred that. And I hope it's that way rather than the latter one. But these new boomer shooters are piling up. There's quite a few for me to play through now. And I say I'll do it, and then I haven't got to them, but I'm sure I will. And I think Reese is going to talk about them.
Yeah, God, I love boomer shooters. Obviously, I don't think you can mention this without mentioning Ion Fury, which was obviously, that was also kind of in the same vein as Duke 3D and used the build engine. That was 2019 and played through that at the time, absolutely loved it. And I believe the sequel or the new episode actually came out earlier this month. So looking forward to checking that out as well. But I've got such a boomer shooter backlog at the minute. So I've been playing through Quake 2, obviously the Night Dive remaster of that, which is excellent. And previously, I'd started on Rise of the Triad and Doom 64 as well. Their remakes of those, got so far with those, and then obviously the next one came out, so I started on that. So I've promised myself that I'm going to complete those before I check out any other boomer shooters, but I think I'm going to be very busy over Christmas just working through the backlog of them. And this does look awesome. It does look very much in the same kind of vein as Duke Nukem 3D, so looking forward to checking it out.
I wonder if this is a flash in the pan type thing. I wonder if we're going to have four right now, we're going to have five or six of them come out and then we'll not get any more, or whether we're going to get them just coming out year by year and it'll be a genre that continues forever. I don't know. Difficult to say.
True. We've also got the Grind project on the Amiga as well. And I mean, I know that's not quite the same thing because that's still on an original platform, but that's at the end of the day, it's another game in this genre. So that's one to look forward to. And you've reminded me there, Reese, I haven't actually played Iron Fury at all. So that's one I can say.
Oh, I have. It's very good.
Yeah. So that's cool. Duke itself, it was taking the mickey out of 80s action movies, as we all know. And this is clearly taking the mickey out of Duke. So in the same vein, it also ends up doing the same thing, I think, in terms of feeling that B movie. I think you're going to like it, Dave. It's going to be good. Thanks, Christoph Why Do You and Pajaco 6507 for bringing this to my attention. And I personally don't care that it's a female and not Duke himself. I'm a fan of female characters in games like Lara Croft and Bayonetta, for example. So this is nothing new. And I just love the run and gun nature of this genre.
I'm glad they've gone for a female rather than trying to do Duke but not Duke, if you know what I mean. Try to do a copy of Duke but make it legally distinct. Making it a female instead avoids that completely. It means they can create a new character with the same kind of spirit about it without having to say, this is not Duke, but he looks exactly like him.
Yeah, I have to say, Shelley in Iron Fury, the humour was absolutely spot on, and I think it was brilliant as her kind of being the opposite of Duke kind of thing. I think it worked very well. So looking forward to more of that, definitely.
That sounds like my kind of game then. I definitely need to check out Iron Fury. Yeah, fantastic. Whereas the character in this, you know, she's just happens to be female. She's a bug exterminator. Could have been male or female. It doesn't really matter. And it just sounds like really good premise. She's a bug exterminator and alien bugs have invaded the planet. So, you know, quite a good storyline. Not that it needs one. So, yeah, I'm just glad that there's so many indie devs that are seeing boomer shooters as something they want to develop. And even though the graphics of The Last Exterminator are purposely not modern, I think if Duke Nukem Forever had come out with the same story that it had, right, but the look and feel and, most importantly, the pacing of The Last Exterminator, it would have actually been better than what we got. So, because this just feels right and it feels like a progression. So I just don't want a shooter peppered in cutscenes and narrative. I just want to lock and load and shoot at things and have a good laugh while I'm doing it. So, you know, if the full version of Last Exterminator lets me do that, then, Dave?
Yeah, talking about that, there's a RoboCop game coming out soon. Maybe it's even out. Maybe I've forgotten about it. It's now
out. It's out.
I looked at the gameplay footage for it and it looked great. It was a bit slower, so you're plodding along like a tank, chewing through all the bad guys rather than ducking and diving. And then someone made a comment about it, about the amount of extra cutscenes and narrative and so on. And I think, I don't want that really. So I've forgotten about it. I'll get to it, I'm sure. Another thing for the backlog. But yeah, I just want to shoot people in the face.
I think I've mentioned this before, but Wolfenstein and New Order had the same problem. You know, if you think back to Wolfenstein 3D, it was just run and gun shooter because they couldn't fit anything much else into the game at that point. But even when you go to Return to Castle Wolfenstein, that did have cutscenes, but they were quite minimal. And again, the game was nice, fast-paced, and there was something drawing you in from the very start. But then you get to something like Wolfenstein New Order and you find yourself in some submission where you've literally got to try and scrape mold off of concrete walls. That's not gaming.
Yeah.
That's not gaming. And, you know, you walk across the room and then you have to talk to another character. And then some of the cutscenes are interesting. There's a great one on the train. But other than that, it just slows the pace of the game down. It's absolutely terrible. But, yeah, Last Exterminator, hail to the queen, baby.
We are sponsored this week by PCBWay, so thank you very much for sponsoring us. PCBWay are a large company that does not just PCBs, they do all sorts of other stuff. You can do on their website, have a look, they do 3D printing, CNCing, sheet metal fabrication, all sorts of stuff. They also have a shared library of projects you can browse through, and it's always worthwhile looking through, seeing what's there, giving yourself a little inspiration of something you can order and fiddle together for yourself. Rhys, have you had a look through that? Was there anything you spotted?
Yeah, I have had a look through it, actually. There's one that I've been wanting to build for years now, which is the WeC, which is like a tiny, it's like a tiny, like pocket-sized MS-DOS PC. You know, it's like a full-blown 486 PC. So that's on PCBWay's shared project. So I know Clint of LGR built one or had one at some point. And ever since I've seen that video, I thought, yeah, that looks really cool. I'd really like to put one of those together.
Well, PCBWay, for that and the rest of the shared projects, 3D printing and all the rest of it, go to PCBWay.com. Thank you very much for sponsoring the show. These days, I'm watching perhaps a little bit less YouTube content than I have done in the past. It comes and goes, though, so it goes in waves. And I'll be back to watching loads again soon. I've been adding a few to my watch later. But I've been watching box sets on the TV instead for a change. But there's a submission this week of a video that really compelled me to watch it. As soon as I saw what it was, I clicked and I watched it all the way through, and I wasn't disappointed. It's a bit of a groundbreaking video in terms of me for retro. Now, as many of you know, I like the idea of a perfect restoration of something. It's one of the reasons that I like the RMC channel, and I mean the real RMC, not the Reese knockoff one. The idea of taking something that's old and damaged and broken and bringing it all the way back, not just electronically, but in the way it looks as well. And over the years, there's been lots of talk about retrobriting and the various different methods and what causes it. And I think there's now a broad consensus, at least in the circles that I'm in, that the best way is to use the vapor method. And I've tried it myself and I was delighted with the result. But retrobriting isn't just the end of the story. We can get reproduction badges and stickers. We can obviously clean things up. We can use an ultrasonic cleaner. I love a PCB and an ultrasonic cleaner. It comes out lovely. But we can use baking soda and super glue to help repair things by creating a structure. But the rusty metal inside them, well, now I've never seen it done until now. That's not to say it hasn't been done. Maybe I've just missed it, but now I've seen it done. So a channel called Retro Crazy, which is a new one to me, but it's hosted by a man with a very calming Scottish accent, so that's always a plus. Inspired to do it by a C64 refurb he's doing, he's created a nickel solution by running electricity through nickel in a vinegar solution to dissolve to add the nickel into the solution. He's cleaned off various metal parts from inside the C64, including using hydrochloric acid to finish it off, and then he's electroplated them. Now, electroplating works by passing a current through a solution, and it causes the nickel in one of the poles, I can't remember if it's the anode or the cathode, and the solution then goes onto the other side, and it can result in a lovely, clean, shiny finish. We might have even... I saw it done in school in the chemistry lab, but I've not seen it done since then. And I know there's all sorts of stuff that I think galvanizing might work a similar way. I'm not quite sure. Now, Rhys, I don't think you do a lot of content about a full cosmetic restoration of projects. You tend to go more on the history of things, but I have seen you restoring some things. Now that you have the extra space, do you think maybe you'd like to have a small area set aside for vapor brighting, for ultrasonic cleaning, and maybe even for electroplating?
Yeah, I mean, this video was really interesting. The short answer to that is yes. I've done my fair share of retro writing over the years, of course. I need to do a follow-up video actually on some of that stuff because had some quite interesting long-term results, but I think that's a different story. But yeah, I would like to set up a proper kind of retro writing area with the box with the UV LEDs and stuff. As for electroplating, yeah, it's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because I have had some stuff that I've restored over the years where obviously, like the RF shielding inside is just so far gone that I've actually just taken it out and chucked away, I'm ashamed to say, just because it was so rusty and was just beyond saving. And obviously with the hydrochloric acid and the electroplating with nickel, you can kind of get it back, at least cosmetically, to looking basically as new. I think it is a really interesting thing to investigate. So, yeah.
I'm not sure about the RF shielding where it's really that thin metal. I think that might be a bit of a struggle to get right, because one of the important things that he needs to do is get the metal, get all the rust and damage off the metal, get it down to the bare metal first, and that's where that really thin, the RF shielding can be really thin, that might struggle there. Now, I know that you've done a lot of cosmetic stuff, Chris. I've seen your results on that. Is hydrochloric acid a step too far from you? Would you like your shielding and so on to be nice and shiny? Or is this something that's a bit much for you?
Well, anyone who's owned a backyard pool, which is everybody in Australia, has had to mess with hydrochloric acid. So that's no worry there. I'm not fussed about messing about with that. But I do tend to buy my kit. I've only done, I think it was this A1200 here, actually, that I retro-brided. And a keyboard just as an experiment. But it's not something I get my hands dirty with that often or through choice, because I tend to just spend a bit more and buy kit that's already well-presented, if that makes sense. And the shielding inside my A500 looks like it was brand new. Like, there's no marks on that. But the only thing that is possibly a contender for it is... this RF shielding. I've got an RF shielding from the A1200. It didn't have RF shielding in it, but I got this off somebody else, and it's already been cleaned up, but it's certainly got some black spots. So he's basically cleaned off all the rust, scraped all that off and what have you. So it doesn't look too bad, but obviously you've still got the discoloration left behind. So that could be a contender, but my only concern is, from what he was using in the video, I'm going to need a bigger jar, Dave, to fit an RF shielding in. Yeah. I'm going to need a much bigger jar.
In the video he's using, it's parts from a C64, so it's keyboard supports, and I think the cartridge shielding and so on are thicker metal, as well as the RF modulator cage. And I think what's the name of the chip in the C64 that does the video? That's in a case. It's in its own little metal box. I can't remember the name of it, but that one there, is it the VIC-20? Not the VIC-20. The
VIC chip. Yeah.
Chip? Yeah, that one there, I think, is in its own little cage, and I think that's what he's doing rather than the thin RF shielding. But yeah, absolutely fascinating. As for the video itself, what the results? Well, I don't want to spoil it because I thoroughly enjoy watching the whole video, and I wouldn't want to take that away from anyone. So I would urge you to go and watch it. It's a great video. It's really well structured, and he's done it very well. But I will say the results are at least worthwhile and promising. So it's not a bad idea. But as to how it comes out at the end, go and watch the video. Enjoy it. Shall we go into housekeeping? Chris, Dave, we need to talk about something today.
No, before we talk about that, I do want to, we'll talk about this other thing first. And then I know what you want to talk about, because you think, well, you're right. Yeah, you were right about something and I was wrong about something again. But yeah, we'll get to that. What I do want to quickly point out was there's so much that goes on behind the scenes. So another opportunity to once again thank producer Duncan for the awesome work he puts in and how much he puts up with us and whatever. And sometimes it's stuff that we have no control over that catches us out. So there was a bit of an issue with last week's episode where potentially we couldn't have used some of the overlay footage due to a copyright issue, but the owner of the video, we had asked for permissions, and the owner of the video was very responsive and got on to the company that was trying to make the claim and got it all sorted out for us. So I just once again want to thank Anthony from Mondo Video for the footage that he supplied for last week's video. And just please do check out his channel at Mondo Video Store on YouTube because, yeah, great guy, and we really appreciate your help because it kind of saved the episode for us after all of Duncan's hard work. Go on then, Dave, correct me again.
So who made the Spectrum Plus 2? Was it Sinclair or was it Amstrad?
I believe 100% that I was non-committal in the way I said, was it Spectra? Was it Sinclair that made the first Plus? Was it? I believe is how I said it. I certainly wasn't 100% sure. Uh-huh. But yeah. Well, let's be honest here. So we've had input from two sources. I know one of them you're going to talk about. But because I was unsure, I put a question up on one of the Facebook groups I'm in, which is, I think it's Spectrum for Everyone, I think was the one I used. And look, there's a lot to be said about, you know, group wisdom. And basically there were 69 votes on a poll where I asked, was the Plus 2 made by Sinclair or Amstrad? And 95% said Amstrad. And a couple of people chimed in the comments as well. Andy said, Amstrad released in early 87, having taken over Sinclair in April of 86. And Stuart then further chimes in saying the first Plus 2s were out in November of 86, which is kind of how I remember it. They were certainly out around Christmas, possibly even October, he says. So there we go. It was close. It was very close.
Well, there's a submission to the subreddit as well. It's actually a top submission this week with more clarity on it. And it matches my understanding entirely. The first thing that Alan Sugar did when he acquired Sinclair was to take the 128K Spectrum Plus and turn it into the Plus 2 and Amstradify it. So what he did was he took the 128K, often called the Toast Rack, which is the black design, which is probably the inspiration behind the Spectrum Next, the design of that. He took that and he added a data set to a cassette recorder to it and put it into a grey shell, which was more in line with the CPC 464 of the time. And the submission to the subreddit actually has a link to Alan Sugar's explanation on it. But he did it so quickly. It was done super, super quickly after he acquired it. So it makes sense that you were a bit confused about it, because by the time that magazines would have heard about it and written their articles and gone to press, you're probably a lag of a couple of months behind. And but that was the point at which he had that Amstrad, the Plus 2, arriving in the shops. So it would have seemed logical that there's no way that the Amstrad were involved in that. It must have been coming from Sinclair anyway. So I don't think you can be too badly blamed for that one. But yeah, Plus 2 is an Amstrad machine. Now, there's been quite a bit of chat about what I said on CDs last week, and I want to say that I've not changed my opinion on it, but I want to be a bit clearer. The long and short of it is that I think the idea that a PlayStation is a better CD player than ones, modern ones costing thousands, is clearly nonsense. Yes, I'm aware of jitter and error correction and so on, but I think if you can hear jitter or error correction, then you're using a very, very ill CD player or a very cheap one. I don't think it's the case that audiophiles are really faced with a choice of either a 1987 Bush portable CD player or a Macintosh or Burmester costing thousands. I don't think that's the only two choices that exist. I think anything reasonable will produce the same sound as far as humans are concerned. And anything that any differences there between reasonable ones will be differences that don't perhaps exist as far as hearing is concerned. Not to say that, again, to reiterate, I'm not saying people shouldn't do these PlayStation mods. Knock yourself out, have great fun with it. Some of them look fantastic, but just don't pretend it's necessary.
Original iMacs, guys, the G3, you know, the one that suddenly put Apple back on the map because it came in any color except beige, and apparently that was cool. Any memories, Dave?
I did not like the aesthetic, and even all these years later, I still don't like it. The aesthetic for some things kind of comes and goes, and you might like it and then not like it, or not like it and then like it. But for these things, I've never liked them. I think they look horrible and ugly. I do recognize, though, that for a lot of people, a Mac is a good choice, and I think these would have been great machines for people. And even now, Macs seem to be possibly turning into a better choice than a PC for people, for certain people. Certainly the M1 and M2 chips they have are fantastic, but these original iMacs, these were ugly, horrible things.
What about you, Reese?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on a Mac nowadays. I've been using the M1 MacBook Air for a couple of years now, doing my editing and stuff on it. It's a fantastic machine. But the original iMac back in the day, I was very much a PC guy at the time. And I had a girlfriend who had one, oddly enough. Her whole family were like a whole Mac family. So they had like the original like toilet seat looking iBook or MacBook or whatever it was called, and the original iMac and all that kind of stuff. And they were weird, and probably less said about them, the better.
Sorry, the Macs were weird, or the people that had them.
Well,
that was ambiguous. No, fair enough. Yeah, I was big into PC at the time as well. And when these dropped, I could see why people liked them, and I can see why it put Apple back on the map for sure, because it was for many people, it was a product that attracted your attention. But it certainly wasn't something that I felt I wanted to buy. And then we had one of my mates move in with us as a housemate for a while, and he had one of these first iMacs. And that's the first and possibly the only time I've ever played games on a Mac. And we played MDK and A10 Cuba, and I actually really liked it. It just played them well. The games were great, and it was a fine little machine to use. Didn't play it long enough to get cramped from that stupid puck mouse. But other than that, yeah, it was quite a pleasant experience. And I also had to use one for work, and we'll come to that a bit later, because the one I used, so it was one of these iMacs, the G3s, and it was touchscreen. And when I raised this a couple of years ago in a discussion group, I was met with heaps of comments saying things like, but they never came out in touchscreen. And that surprised me, because I knew my memory was correct on this. May not have been right about who made the Spectrum Plus 2, but it was definitely correct on this. But those comments were correct as well, because Apple never released it. They were modified. And now this knowledge has become a little bit more mainstream, but it is still quite niche. And vindication comes today in the form of a story and video shared by Dr. Local. This story is ironically on PCMag.com, and it's all about the little-known iTouch screen G3 iMacs and those who provided them. And to be clear, apart from the one cost-effective option, these weren't gimmicks added to the front of the screen by the user. These were custom-installed professional conversions that looked and felt factory. The Elo iTouch featured, which is the feature of the story, even has pressure sensitivity technology, so 3D touch, and this was back in 1999. The video in the story is on a channel called at Michael MJD, and in it, Michael shows off the touchscreen iMac that he's purchased himself and goes into really great detail of the history of who was making them, including Elo, MicroTouch, and Troll Touch. Not the greatest name, as he mentions in his video, but that was one of the companies doing this. And only Elo iTouch didn't use an overlay. Theirs was actually an internal mod. And this is really interesting when you think about the fact that even now, Apple so far have not released an official touchscreen computer outside of their, very specific markets of iPhones and iPads. Their flagship range, their main machines, has never gone touchscreen. So, Reese, did you know about these touchscreen iMacs? And what are your thoughts on touchscreen PCs and laptops?
Yeah, I wasn't aware of the iMacs. Certainly something I hadn't come across. But when it comes to like modern laptops and stuff, I have to say I'm not a fan. Generally, when people have them and they actually use the touchscreen, the screen just ends up all smeared and fingerprints all over the place, which I'm not a fan of. Yeah. But I must say, in my day job, I do quite a lot of stuff with touchscreens for like point of sale displays and like factory stuff and that kind of thing. And obviously, they're very, very useful in that kind of setting where you don't want people interacting with a keyboard and mouse, or potentially, you know, trashing them or stealing them or whatever. So I'm not quite sure how much use that would be on a Mac, because you know, all of that stuff tends to be sort of Windows or Linux based. But yeah, a really interesting piece of history.
I think a touchscreen for those Macs is a great addition. I think those Macs were aimed to be kind of, I say more for casual users, and I don't mean that in a kind of in a lightweight way. I mean people who were perhaps using it more for the internet and email, when that was computers struggled to do that very well. It wasn't the trivial way that they do them these days. So a touchscreen might have been a better option, for example, for my dad, to make it easier to use. So just like Fisher-Price toys. Being serious, though, I think if you had a touchscreen, you needed to do it right. I think touchscreen technology, until smartphones, as far as I'm concerned, until smartphones, touchscreen technology was rotten and it was unreliable, and you're touching someone that's not working. Even these days, when you go to use a cash machine that's a touchscreen cash machine, they seem to have these ones that look about 20 years old. They're rotten. They're terrible. And cars with touchscreens instead of buttons. I know that buttons are now coming back in. But again, unless the touchscreen's really good, it's a bad idea. So I was quite impressed with how well this was done, that it was properly integrated, and it did look factory. It didn't just look like something you've stuck on the outside with a wire going into the back of it. And I actually do have a touchscreen PC that I use as a touchscreen PC in my house, and I love it. It's it looks like a 24-inch widescreen monitor that's a bit thicker at the back, and that's because that's what it is. It's a Chrome base, which is Google's OS running on an all-in-one PC, and it tilts so that I'm looking down at it as if you would do with a book or a magazine, and I use it for magazines. It happens to be a 24-inch monitor, happens to be roughly the size of a full-size magazine opened up with two pages showing, and it's a breeze to use it for old PDF scans of magazines. In fact, I've used it to read Pixel Addict on PDF on it too. It's not quite as good as holding an actual magazine. I mean, nothing compares to holding an actual magazine, but it's not far away, and because it is a touchscreen, I don't need to have a keyboard or mouse. I've just got that in front of me, and I can swipe across the screen to easily move between pages. It's perfect for that. It's lovely.
It's funny, actually, because, you know, when we first started to get the decent touchscreen devices, like, you know, the smartphones and tablets, I was shouting till I was blue in the face that what people want is a device with a full operating system, not these cut-down operating systems. But then... When the touchscreen laptop started to emerge, because that's what we all thought we wanted, and Windows certainly forced us into that with the Windows 8, the first edition of that, I hated it. I absolutely hated it, because then you've got smudges all over your screen, like you said, Reese, and that's the last thing you want. And all the screens were glossy as well, and as a migraine sufferer, the last thing I want is a glossy screen covered in fingerprint smudges. It really isn't good. I've still got two laptops that have touchscreens fitted in them. They're getting quite old now, but the first thing I do when I re-image those machines is I disable the touch control so I can just use it as an ordinary laptop, you know, and resist the urge for smudging it. Absolutely hate it. But back to my vindication of my memories of these touchscreen iMacs. Yes, I used one, and it was back in around 99 2000. And so basically the company I worked for was like a PR company for the pharmaceutical industry, and we part of what we did was we would do content and designs and stuff for exhibition booths for that industry. And so one of the AV companies that we used to use let us know that they had these touchscreen iMacs. So my boss, who was an ex-BBC cameraman, he was working in Macromedia Director, and he put together this interactive video program, essentially, that took... It was mainly, you know, obviously doctors and stuff at these expos, and it took them through a series of case studies, patient case studies, and then they would have to then touch the screen, you know, tap on these buttons to choose how they would treat the patient, and then it moved on to the next video. And it was a really exciting project to be involved in terms of the video shoot. I was just the gaffer and the dolly grip. If you've ever done dolly grip, that looks a lot looks easier than it is, pushing the dolly along at the right speed. And the other part I had to do, and this is where it gets interesting, is I had to create a screensaver, so like an attract mode, think of it like an attract mode, to entice people to touch the screen because it wasn't intuitive back then. You know, walking around an exhibition space, there were no touch screens on these exhibition booths. And so this was, it was quite cutting edge.
You had to tell people that it was touchscreen when they weren't expecting it to be touchscreen.
Yeah. So my I literally did a screensaver that sort of had this sort of 3D hand that sort of came in from behind the viewer, you know, in terms of the flat screen, and then clicked on the buttons to reveal certain, you know, bits of text. Then it said, touch the screen. Because otherwise people were just walking past, not realizing they could actually interact with this booth because we'd taken the keyboard and the mouse away.
It reminds me of a prank that I've seen done, which is a sign stuck on a printer that says this printer is now voice activated.
And it's not.
Just to get people to stand there and go, print, hello, 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 print.
That's awesome. Reese?
Yeah, I was going to say, I've had the exact same as well with work-based stuff. I think one of the very first projects I did sort of 10 plus years ago, we did have to have a big flashing touch me on the screen because people just weren't expecting it to be a touch screen. And obviously all the stuff that we do nowadays, we don't need that because people kind of try to poke at them by default. So it's interesting how quickly it's all changed.
It's true. It's almost the opposite now, isn't it? People get confused when they touch the screen and nothing happens. Like, what do you mean? Well, oh, there's a controller here. What's that for? Yeah, it's crazy. The AV company we used to hire those from, and I remember this clearly, this is why I've got such vivid memories of this because of my involvement, they then turned around and said they were going to get rid of them. And so we were pretty much left with no choice but to purchase them because we couldn't find anywhere else we could get them from. And we wanted to keep using them so that we could keep using this program on future exhibitions. So it was really cool. Also, one of the easiest days of work I've ever had in my life. I literally had to go, one of the expos was in Paris. So I had to get on the Eurostar first thing in the morning, go to the place where the expo was, hang around for about 3 hours because things weren't ready. And as soon as I was told by the guy setting the actual exhibition platform up that he was ready for me to do my bit, I set the machines up, got them running, and then went to the pub, had a couple of beers, and then back on the Eurostar, back home again. Fantastic day's work. Great work if you can find it. But anyway, I don't have many fond Mac memories. Apple is best left to ferment and used in cider, but the G3 iMac and playing those games I mentioned is actually one of the fond memories I do have and one of the few times that I've thought twice about Macs. And also that touchscreen iMac and my involvement in that project is definitely etched in my memory as one of the more interesting and cutting edge things I've had the privilege of being involved in. I'm very grateful to my then boss, Jim, for the opportunities. Dave?
Yeah, there's this impression that Macs didn't really have any games going for them. Hmm. And you did get some on the kind of classic Macintosh, the kind of all-in-one black and white ones. There were some games on that. But in this period of Macs, in the late 90s, there was actually a fair bit of gaming going on, and it was a good place to play games. And I think it kind of faded away a bit, certainly after that. But there was a fair bit of gaming going on. I know that the X-Wing and TIE Fighter things had the Mac ports were ported back to the PC because they were good enough for that. So yeah, there was a fair bit of Mac gaming going on that I don't really know much about other than people talking about it.
Yeah, I'm not a fan, but again, because of the history of things like the M1 processor and how it arcs back to the days of Acorn, obviously, I've sort of got a renewed interest. And even I'm thinking when I'm next ready for probably a laptop, mainly because these days when you buy a PC laptop, the battery life just seems to be a complete gamble. Regardless of what they tell you on the box, it just seems to be a gamble. Whereas Apple, you seem to be fairly safe. They don't make, somebody will shoot me for this, but I say they don't make a bad product. They're just very expensive.
Yeah, I will say the MacBook Air, the battery life is absolutely fantastic because it's completely fanless as well. So, I mean, I quite often, I go to an office where it's a bit of a pain to sort of crawl under the desk and have to plug it in. So a lot of the time I just don't bother. And I can sit and do a full, you know, 8 hour day on the Wi-Fi, you know, remote desktop into stuff and everything. And I'm still on like 20-30% battery at the end of the day. So it's crazy.
That's really cool.
That's impressive.
That's the kind of thing that will possibly attract me over. You have to be a bit careful over here in Australia at the moment, because it's just the nature. We tend to pay a bit more for stuff over here, and you'll see sale and there'll be a great price on a MacBook Air, and then you bother to read the print and it's like, well, that's an M1. I want the M2. And you can't get the M2 for a decent price. So they kind of catch you out there. But also, I think why games did work well on the Mac, and maybe we're all wrong in staying with the PC, but the PC, in terms of what somebody might have on their desk or under the desk, is almost infinite in terms of the setup. Yeah. Have they got, what GPU have they got? How much RAM? What, you know, all of these different possibilities. Whereas the Mac is a very closed ecosystem, and it was back then, and it still is now. So you can write to the hardware just like you do with a games console.
Yeah.
So it's actually not a bad thing. But anyway, thanks, Dr. Local, PC Mag, and Michael MJD for the vindication, and also just for the memories.
I should point out that my story was submitted, thank you very much, to the subreddit by Mogwai, and I didn't point that out. So thank you very much, Mogwai. Sorry about that. On to the community question of the week. Last week we posed the question, are you using any of your retro kit to do something other than its main purpose? For example, are you using the original PlayStation as a CD player, or using an Amstrad CPC 464 as a wallpaper pasting table or a load bearing wall in your home? So we've asked a question and I'm going to go on and find out what the answer is. And I'm kind of stalling just now because I need to go in and go log into it and then take it out of contest mode so that I can see the answers in order of as how people have ranked them. And I'm nearly there, so I've nearly talked all the way through me doing this, and I'm clicking the button to disable contest mode now. Contest mode is disabled, so we are ready, or locked and loaded and ready to go. Who wants to read out the first one, Chris?
Yes, Chris will, because it's Rich. Hi, Rich. And Richard Shears, still using my PS3 to play Blu-rays and DVDs. Absolutely. Yes, that's what I used to do in mine. But for a retro answer, the PS3 still doesn't feel retro. It's never been removed from active use. So he says, I frequently use my 233 MMX PC with OR64 to play MIDI files. There's just something satisfying about the sound that seems unique, typically with a screensaver from the Windows Plus pack playing. Also, I've also been known to drop it back to good old DOS and fire up a few games such as Doom just for background ambience whilst working. Fantastic. And now I've bored everyone with my unexpiring answer. I'll shut up now.
Reese, would you like to read out the next one?
I would, yes. It's funny you should mention MIDI. So the second answer is from Taste of the Murder, and it just says, I use my Atari ST for games and not MIDI. Oof, self-burn.
Yeah, I think Atari STs get used a lot more for games than MIDI, really. Next one is Tungsten Orchid. The example that springs to mind is my old PS3. It was the most affordable way to get a Blu-ray player at the time. I'll shut up now. Now, we actually did look into this on Discord, and it's a bit of a myth that it's the most affordable way to get a Blu-ray player at the time. It's not. It was actually cheaper to go and get one of the ones you see at Asda or Walmart or whatever piled up, and you take it and it's a basic one. They were cheaper than the PS3, but the PS3 was about the price of a reasonable one. And I think if you were going to go and buy one, it was easy to say, well, I'll get the PS3 instead and get myself a lot more for my money.
It might be where you are in the world as well, because in Australia it definitely was. It was just the
really
cheapest way. There was, in all of the electronic shops I ever went in, it was the cheapest way. And they were $1,000, keep in mind. The PS3 was $1,000, and it was still the cheapest Blu-ray player at the time. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
So it might just depend on where you were in the world and what the options were available to you.
It was US prices that I looked up for it. I looked up what the kind of cheapest kind of this'll do the job player was, and then I looked at the PS3 price.
Yeah, no, it was certainly true for the PS2, wasn't it? I think that, you know, people were saying at the time that it was the cheapest way to get a DVD player, although I may have just opened a whole can of worms with that one as well.
It wasn't, again, DVD players, you could get cheaper ones, but if you're going to buy it, if you're going to spend $120 on a DVD player, then maybe is it much of a stretch to say I'll spend $200 and get this, at the time, a fantastic console at the time? So, yeah, I get that, yeah. There's a few more answers. CRG says he uses his Amiga 2000 to play music while he's working. Mods are just running demos.
Nice.
Antiques for Geeks uses a CD TV to use a CD player, with a bonus of it being an Amiga on the side. G4 Max.
That feeds into the Mac story. I love it. Super Cruiser 5000. Yeah. So he says, I'd love to use a couple of G4 Max as a bench, but that would be a waste of wood. Fantastic. Yeah.
There's a lot more of those. Anyway, thank you very much for submitting it. And on to Chris, what is the question for this week for our listeners?
I'd come up with two questions, but I think just based on that last response from last week, I think it's time. I think we need to open a can of worms. Mac yes. or PC? Mac yes. or PC? Which camp were you in? And why? Which camp are you in and why? Because it might have changed. Let us know. Let's have that fight. Mac or PC?
And no reasonable answers, please. Have a bit of fun. Troll mode on.
Nice.
Thank you very much for appearing this week, Rhys. Filling in for Neil, who is busy. That's hopefully coming to an end soon, and in November hopefully things back to normal, but thank you for coming on, Rhys. I hope you enjoyed it. I would suggest that you have a check out Rhys's channel, particularly at the moment as things are getting exciting with the new space. At least I'm finding it exciting talking about the new space and what Rhys will develop it into. Join us again next week, and thank you for being here. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
I'm gonna wave. Chris is waving. Rhys is waving. Bye-bye. Hello, Johnny. Hi. Wave, Johnny.
This Week in Retro was presented by Neil from RMC The Cave, Chris from 005 Agema, and Dave. It was produced by me, Duncan Stiles. The podcast version of the show is available to your favourite podcaster, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and the video version is available on the This Week in Retro YouTube channel.
Join our community subreddit at r/thisweekinretro to suggest and vote on the stories we cover on the show. If you watch This Week in Retro on YouTube, please give us a like and subscribe to help us reach new viewers.
If you enjoy our show and would like to support it, then please check out the link to our Patreon page in the show notes or description. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time for more up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.